From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. How many times have you seen The Wizard of Oz, and you still don't know how they made the Wicked Witch of the West disappear in a cloud of smoke? On today's Fresh Air, we find out how, from Al Jean Harmetz, the author of The Making of The Wizard of Oz. Alan Zweibel got his start writing for Borscht Belt Comics, $7 a joke. Coming up, he tells us how he went on to write for the original cast of Saturday Night Live and co-create The Gary Shandling Show. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie Parenthood, starring Steve Martin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The White House said today a pro-Iranian group's reprieve of Joseph Sisipio is encouraging but does not resolve the plight of foreign hostages in Lebanon or remove the need to keep U.S. warships in the area. Under implicit threat of military retaliation from the United States, the Lebanese group announced shortly before the scheduled killing of Sisipio that it had decided to freeze that threat. Details from Michael Richards.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the announcement by Shiite radicals appears to be credible, and while the president was very pleased about it, it doesn't answer the administration's continuing concern for the release of all hostages. Several U.S. Navy ships have been redeployed in the last few days within striking distance of the Middle East. Fitzwater said there won't be any quick change in their status because there's still a serious hostage problem. Earlier, Fitzwater confirmed reports that the U.S. had warned Iran that it would be held responsible if any harm came to any of the hostages held in Lebanon by its Shiite radical allies. But Iran also inaugurated a new president today, and Fitzwater said the administration is hopeful that Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani would improve relations with the West. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Richards at the White House.
Israeli officials tonight remain cautious in assessing the significance of statements from Beirut today. NPR's John Hockenberry says Israel is taking the report seriously.
Israeli officials are studying the developments from Beirut tonight, but have announced that no reaction is the only official reaction to the reprieve issued for hostage Joseph Sisipio. Israel is principally interested in determining if the Revolutionary Justice Organization has activated consideration of a prisoner swap by drawing up a list of Shiite and Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails and forwarding that list to the International Red Cross. Earlier this week, Israel approached the Red Cross about trading Shiite prisoners and the kidnapped Sheikh Abdul Karim Obeid for foreign hostages, including three Israeli soldiers. The Hezbollah Shiite organization has already rejected the idea of a prisoner swap. Israel is attempting to learn tonight if that position has changed in any way. This is John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
The Soviet Union has accepted U.S. demands that the superpowers begin inspecting each other's chemical weapons sites before a global ban on the weapons is signed. Moscow's shift was conveyed in a memorandum from Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze to Secretary of State James Baker when they met in Paris last week. The U.S. had been demanding the inspections begin before a global ban is signed by the 40-nation Geneva Conference on Disarmament. Hurricane Dean veered away from the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico today, carrying its 85-mile-an-hour winds farther out to sea and reducing the threat to the Florida coast. Forecasters say the second hurricane of the season would probably sweep 150 miles north of Puerto Rico. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 4 points to close at 26.61. This is NPR News. The House today approved a savings and loan industry bailout bill, but the measure faces an uncertain fate because of Republican opposition in the Senate and a veto threat by President Bush. The House approved by 221 to 199 a conference committee version of the bill that would count the costs of the bailout in the federal budget, which is an idea opposed by Bush. One of the bill's supporters, Democrat Charles Schumer, says the legislation will force the industry to act more responsibly.
It tells the thrift industry, you can't play with depositors' money. You must put your own money up front. It tells the regulators they must cut their ties to the industry and the political interest. And it tells those who committed misdeeds that you are going to go to jail, not for 6 months, but more likely for 6 years. It is as tough a bill as anyone could expect, and it is a strong bill.
The Senate scheduled a vote on the bill for later tonight. South African police said today they seized ivory taken from at least 53 illegally slaughtered elephants as it was delivered to a Cape Town for export. The newly formed Endangered Species Protection Unit and conservation officials seized 106 elephant tusks and rhinoceros horn yesterday in the biggest police haul of illegal ivory. The Supreme Soviet today confirmed the first cabinet member who is not a member of the Communist Party, a biologist who will grapple with the country's ecological problems. The national legislature also approved for a cabinet post a regional Communist Party chief who last year shocked the party conference by demanding that longtime Kremlin leaders such as Andrei Gromyko retire. An earthquake hit the North Caucasus region of the Soviet Union today, killing one person and damaging buildings in the city of Grozny. The Soviet news agency TASS reported the epicenter was in a remote mountainous area some 30 miles northwest of Grozny. I'm Frank Stasio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. In the 1950s, the annual TV broadcast of The Wizard of Oz became a ritual. Every year, new children were introduced to the film, while other children and adults watched it again and again. It's hard to find anyone who hasn't seen or doesn't love The Wizard of Oz. August 15th marks the 50th anniversary of this film classic. My guest, Algene Harmetz, is the author of The Making of The Wizard of Oz. A new edition of her 1977 book has been published to coincide with the anniversary. Harmetz has covered the movie industry for The New York Times since 1978. She told me about the scene in The Wizard of Oz that affected her most when she first saw it as a child.
To me, the scariest moment in the movie was the moment when Dorothy is locked in the witch's castle, the sand in the hourglass is running out, and she manages to get Aunt Em into the witch's crystal ball and begs for help, and all of a sudden Aunt Em's face is replaced by the face of the witch saying, "Auntie Em, Auntie Em," was terrifying to me.
So what kind of makeup and prosthetics did she wear?
Margaret Hamilton actually had a green makeup with a copper base. And unlike Haley and Bolger and Lahr, she didn't have terrible prosthetics. Bolger, for instance, had a mask over his entire face. Lahr had a mask which showed only a bit of chin and his eyes, and once it was on, he couldn't eat, so he had to sip his lunch. Margaret Hamilton didn't have that problem. But she was immobilized by the fact that she was coated. Her hands, her face, her arms were all coated with this green paint. And she couldn't do anything for herself. As she said, that included the amenities in the bathroom. So she had to have this little girl who was assigned to her as a kind of maid who helped lift her skirts and also held her peanut butter sandwich when she was eating her lunch. Her rubber pieces on her face, it did take a fairly long time. It took a couple of hours each day. The worst part was this terribly ugly wart, and it had sort of large black hairs protruding from it. And Margaret Hamilton was never a very attractive woman, except on the inside, where she was utterly lovely. But in terms of her look, she was a homely woman, even at the age of 30. And so I think she got more embarrassed and more unhappy than most people would out of being made uglier.
There's a great scene. This is just when Dorothy has arrived in Oz, and her house has killed the Wicked Witch of the East. The Good Witch gives Dorothy the ruby slippers, and the Wicked Witch of the West wants to take those slippers for herself. I wanted to play a clip from that scene.
"Give me back my slippers. I'm the only one that knows how to use them. They're no use to you. Give them back to me. Give them back.
Keep tight inside of them. Their magic must be very powerful, or she wouldn't want them so badly.
You stay out of this, Glinda, or I'll fix you as well."
"Oh, rubbish. You have no power here. Be gone before somebody drops a house on you."
"Very well. I'll bide my time. And as for you, my fine lady, it's true, I can't attend you here and now as I'd like. But just try to stay out of my way. Just try. I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too."
Well, in that explosion, that's the explosion where the Wicked Witch of the West disappears in red smoke and fire. What actually happened during one of the takes of that was that Margaret Hamilton caught on fire. Can you describe what went wrong?
Yes. They had done it before lunch, and they had gotten one take, but the director, Victor Fleming, wanted more for insurance. And as Margaret Hamilton described it to me, what she did was she came back from lunch and everybody was a little loggy and they weren't really going very quickly. They were sort of too full. And four or five times things went wrong. The smoke didn't come up. She didn't disappear properly. And finally, Victor Fleming, who was very much of a Tartar, got extremely angry and he said, as soon as she gets her foot on top of that piece of yellow brick road, I want you to, well, she was to stand on a square of the yellow brick road, which was in actuality a hydraulic lift, an elevator which would take her underneath the stage. And she raised her hand and she said rather timidly, both feet, please, Mr. Fleming. She was not afraid of being burned. It had never occurred to her. She was afraid of breaking her leg. If both of her feet were not properly on that small square of yellow brick road and she had to back up to get on it, she was not walking to it, she was walking backwards to it, she was very much afraid that she would break a leg. So the next time they did the shot, the smoke and the fire came up, she disappeared underneath the stage and she felt a slight sensation of warmth. But when she got underneath the stage, the two stagehands who were stationed there to help her off ran at her, grabbed her broom, grabbed her hat off of her head, and she suddenly realized that her broom had caught fire. The broomstick part had been, the straw part had been right underneath her chin. The whole right side of her face was burned, her right eyebrow was burned off, and her right hand was badly burned. She went home. And she was not needed again for 6 weeks, which was lucky for her because of the fact that MGM would simply have replaced her. They didn't have to because she had the time to recover. But in the rest of the movie, she had to wear a green glove on the right hand because it did not allow itself to have grease paint or even to be touched after that.
Now, why didn't she sue them?
You didn't sue the studios in those days. As she said to me, if I had threatened to sue them, you know, I'd never have worked again. As a matter of fact, she told me about a conversation she had, which she found very queer, where somebody from the studio called her up, and after the conversation was over, she realized that they must have had a secretary on the line taking notes, because the fellow was saying things, well, you're not really hurt, are you? And she had the presence of mind to say, well, yes, of course I am. But she didn't sue them because she wanted to work in Hollywood again.
My guest is Al Jean Harmetz, who covers Hollywood for The New York Times and is the author of the book The Making of The Wizard of Oz. And the book has just been republished in recognition of the 50th anniversary of the film's opening. This film was really a vehicle for Judy Garland. However, we almost got to see Shirley Temple in the lead. Who wanted Shirley Temple to play the role?
The money men in New York. The creative people connected with the movie, Arthur Freed and Mervyn LeRoy, wanted Judy Garland from the very beginning. Actually, Arthur Freed was one of the people who was a Judy Garland backer at MGM. He was a young songwriter, a young assistant producer. In the 40s and 50s, he would make the greatest musicals at the studio that made the greatest musicals in that golden age of musicals. He would make Meet Me in St. Louis. He would win the Academy Award for American in Paris. In those days, he was just a young, ambitious man. And he had helped bring Judy Garland to the studio. He had sponsored her there. She had come 3 years earlier as a girl of 13. And he saw her as the only person to play Dorothy. Unfortunately, the money men in New York wanted box office insurance. And what better box office insurance than Shirley Temple? She'd been the top box office star in America in 1935, 1936, and 1937. MGM's Clark Gable had been a distant second to Shirley Temple. So L.B. Mayer tried to borrow Shirley Temple from 20th Century Fox. If he had succeeded, she would have played in the movie, no matter what the creative people wanted. Luckily, Daryl F. Zanuck did not loan her out.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine Shirley Temple singing a song with the musical range and emotional depth of Over the Rainbow. But speaking of Over the Rainbow, that song was actually almost removed from the movie.
Yes, it was. It was after the film was completed. They used to preview pictures by taking a private car and putting it on the red trolley line and taking it out to one of the outlying districts. In the case of The Wizard of Oz, it went down to San Bernardino, about an hour and a half away from Los Angeles. Usually a lot of the producers on the lot would go along. And after the movie was over, they came to Mayer and they said, no MGM star can sing in a barnyard. Now, Mervyn LeRoy, the producer of the movie, said to me years and years and years later that he thought that they were jealous and that's why they wanted the song removed. I don't know if they were jealous or if they really thought it was beneath the dignity of an MGM star to sing in a barnyard, but indeed, Mayer took the song out of the movie. And it was Arthur Freed, along with the lyricist E.Y. Harburg, who shouted and screamed and begged and got Mayer eventually to put it back in again. And then, of course, Over the Rainbow won one of the two Academy Awards that The Wizard of Oz won in 1939. It lost almost everything else to Gone with the Wind, but it defeated Gone with the Wind in terms of the original score.
Because the lyricist E.Y. Harburg edited part of the script for the movie and also wrote some of the sequences himself, he was able to write the lead-in into the songs. And I think that was a liberty afforded few songwriters who really lost control of their songs once the movie was being made. He wrote the spoken passage into Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And you write a little bit about that in the book.
Yes. What was very special about the movie was that it was one of the very few times in the 30s when the songs in a movie actually advanced the plot. Most places, the songs were sort of like raisins dropped into a plum pudding. They were sort of nice to have, but if you'd taken them out, the whole thing would have been exactly the same. In terms of musicals, Love Me Tonight was the first time that that was done. And Harburg and Arlen were able to do it on The Wizard of Oz. They were able to make each of the songs. For instance, Over the Rainbow definitely was the heart of the movie because it was the yearning of Dorothy to get away someplace where she wouldn't have any troubles. And so it told you in song exactly what was going to happen and where she was going to find herself. Cole Porter, for instance, had the experience of having them buy one of his plays, make it into a movie, and take out all the songs and put in about six other songs instead.
Let me play this transition from the dialogue into the song of Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And I believe this transition was written by the lyricist E.Y. Harburg, yes?
Yes, he was able to do that.
Okay, here we go.
Annie M., really? You know what Miss Gus said she was going to do to Toto? She says she
now,
was going to...
Now, Dorothy, dear, stop imagining things. You always get yourself into a fret over nothing. Uh-huh. Now, you just help us out today and find yourself a place where you won't get into any trouble.
Some place where there isn't any trouble.
Do you suppose there is such a place, Toto?
There must be.
It's not a place you can get to by a boat or a train. It's far, far away. Behind the moon, beyond the rain.
Judy Garland when she made The Wizard of Oz.
Judy was 16 years old. So she actually had her 17th birthday during the filming of the movie. In L. Frank Baum's book, Dorothy was a child of 5 or 6. And in an attempt to make Judy Garland into, I think, what would have been the equivalent of, say, a 12-year-old, she was corseted, severely corseted, to hold her breasts down. And she was put into the costume, actually, that came out of the book. They did that in almost every case. They tried to recreate the characters' costumes or the way they looked in The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, published by L. Frank Baum in 1900.
Well, I want to talk with you more about the making of The Wizard of Oz, but first we're going to take a short break. Algene Harmetz is my guest, and she writes about Hollywood for The New York Times. She covers the film industry. Her new book, The Making of The Wizard of Oz, has just been republished in honor of the 50th anniversary of the premiere of the movie. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Algene Harmetz is my guest, and we're discussing her book, The Making of The Wizard of Oz. I always like to imagine how movies would look if all the original actors that were supposed to be cast in it ended up in the final production. We had talked about how Shirley Temple was almost cast in the Judy Garland part, and Buddy Ebsen was originally cast in the role of the Tin Man.
Actually, he was originally cast as the Scarecrow. If people at the studio, various people that had their druthers, this is the cast you would have seen in The Wizard of Oz. Buddy Ebsen as the Scarecrow, Ray Bolger as the Tin Man, Shirley Temple as Dorothy, W.C. Fields as the Wizard, and Gail Sondergaard as a very slinky, glamorous Wicked Witch with sequins. First thing that happened was that Ray Bolger, who had always wanted to play the Scarecrow, he'd seen a touring performance of the play when he was a young boy, went to L.B. Mayer and he begged him to allow him to switch roles with Buddy Ebsen and to become the Scarecrow. He said that, quite properly, he said he was a soft shoe dancer, that he was not stiff. He was a floppy dancer, and Mayer did allow this. Buddy Ebsen, who was a young dancer under contract to the studio, didn't care just so long as he was in the movie. It didn't matter to him if he was a Tin Man or if he was a Scarecrow. And so he took over the role of the Tin Man, and about 10 days into the shooting, he took a deep breath one night, and he couldn't breathe, and he was rushed to the hospital, put in an oxygen tent. He had been poisoned by his makeup. Essentially, the aluminum dust that they powdered on his face, he had inhaled and it had coated his lungs. And the studios were no more gentlemanly then than they are now, so learning that he wouldn't be available for a few weeks, they simply replaced him with Jack Haley.
There really were quite a few accidents and toxic poisoning type of incidents on the
Wizard
of Oz.
Yes, well, when Haley came in, A, they didn't tell him what had happened to Ebsen. Didn't really tell anybody what had happened to Ebsen. And B, they made sure they didn't powder aluminum dust on his face. What they did was they put on a white chalky material to close his pores, and then they painted over it with an aluminum paste. So he didn't have anything to breathe in. However, some of the paste got in his eye and caused a serious eye infection.
Was this pretty typical of movies with special effects at the time, that that actors and people working on the sound stages would end up with health problems because of the materials they were working with?
Oh, absolutely. One of the technicians who was in the special effects department told me, just with almost awe in his voice, he said, he told me how they made the breakaway glass that Burt Lahr jumped through when he jumped out of the wizard's throne room. It was a sugary material, and he said it was on a bed of mercury, a pool of mercury. And he just, even 35 years, 40 years later, he shivered. He said, we didn't know anything. We didn't know how harmful it was. We were working with mercury. We didn't know anything about it at all. When they made the cyclone, the guy who stood up on top of the stage and pushed Fuller's earth into the muslin windsock that they were using as a cyclone said that for days afterwards he was spitting up sulfur and yellow mucus. Nobody paid very much attention to safety in those days.
My guest is Algene Harmetz, and we're talking about her book, The Making of the Wizard of Oz. You wrote The Making of the Wizard of Oz over 10 years ago. It's just been republished in honor of the anniversary of the release of the film. When you wrote it, there were more people alive who participated in the making of this movie than there are now. You must feel really glad to have been able to speak to them when you did, and I'm thinking about how unreliable the film reporting of the time must have been as a source, because the film reporting was so loaded with lies that were concocted by the studio publicists.
Absolutely. There was a 16-page press material that was put out by Howard Strickling, the head of MGM's publicity department, and there isn't one statement in that whole thing that's true. And it's just amazing. It said things like there were 500 munchkins in the movie. There were 6,000 people who worked on the movie. Well, there were only 3,000 people at the studio at the time. Every single thing, they just made it up out of whole cloth. I think people's memories are much better, actually, and I was extremely lucky because now everyone connected with the movie is dead. Margaret Hamilton, Ray Bolger, Mervyn LeRoy, Buddy Gillespie, who did all of the special effects, Jack Haley, all of those people were alive, and I was able to do hours and hours and hours of tape recording with them.
Well, I want to thank you for telling us a little bit about what happened behind the scenes at The Wizard of Oz. Thank you for being with us.
Hey, thank you very much, Terry.
My guest has been Algene Harmetz, and her book, The Making of the Wizard of Oz, is published by Delta. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Myra Lewis. When she was just 13 years old, she married her cousin Jerry Lee Lewis, and the scandal that followed destroyed his career. Myra Lewis wrote an autobiography called Great Balls of Fire, and it was what the recent film was based on. I hope you can join us.
But it wasn't a dream. It was a place. And you, and you, and you, and you were there.
Oh,
sure. But you couldn't have been, could you?
Oh, we dream lots of silly things when we...
No, Aunt Em. This was a real, truly live place. And I remember that some of it wasn't very nice, but most of it was beautiful. But just the same, all I kept saying to everybody was, I want to go home. And they sent me home. Doesn't anybody believe me?
Of course we believe you, don't we?
Oh, but anyway, Toto, we're home. Home. And this is my room. And you're all here. And I'm not going to leave here ever, ever again. Because I love you all. And, oh, Annie M., there's no place like home.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mother-in-law jokes, send the kids to camp jokes, honeymoon jokes. If you ever heard a comic at New York's Catskill Resort Hotels, then you know the Borscht Belt humor that Alan Zweibel used to write. On today's Fresh Air, Alan Zweibel talks about writing comedy from $7 a joke to Saturday Night Live and now The Gary Shandling Show. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Parenthood, the new comedy directed by Ron Howard, starring Steve Martin and Rick Moranis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Doreen McAllister. In Lebanon, the Revolutionary Justice Organization says it has replaced its death threat against Joseph Sosipio with an initiative calling for the release of Sheikh Abdul Obeid and Lebanese and Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. Mike Theodulou has details from Cyprus.
It's what the American government, Sosipio's family, and millions of ordinary people around the world had hoped for. But the crisis is far from over. They've offered to free Sosipio's death sentence, not to release him. The group said it had responded to the intercession of an intermediary put forward by America, reportedly the Algerian ambassador to Beirut. But it's likely there's also been pressure from Iran, whose new president, Hashemi Rafsanjani, has vowed to end his country's isolation, a virtually impossible feat if pro-Iranian kidnappers kill the second American hostage. Sosipio's captors are far from happy at being pressured. They said, "We would have preferred that diplomacy had failed and we had executed the spy Sosipio, trapping America and rubbing its nose again in the memory of what happened in 1983. A reference to a suicide truck bomb that killed 241 American Marines in their Beirut barracks. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulou in Nicosia.
Word that Sosipio's execution was suspended brought a muted reaction from the Bush administration. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Administration officials say they don't want anyone to lose sight of the fact that, despite the reprieve, Sosipio is still a hostage. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the freeze in Sosipio's death sentence is an encouraging and hopeful development. But he added, it still does not answer our continuing concern for release of all hostages. State Department spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler called Sosipio's death sentence and the delays cynical manipulation.
It is also a very cruel and inhumane situation for the individuals and their families. The United States calls for the safe and unconditional release of our hostages.
The Bush administration is asking all parties with influence over the hostage takers to work for the hostages' freedom. Today, the administration offered its most positive assessment so far of Iran's role in the crisis. Tutwiler said, "We have no reason to believe that Iran is not dealing with this matter in a serious way." This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Despite the threat of a presidential veto, the House today approved a $166 billion savings and loan bailout bill. The plan would increase the federal deficit by $44 billion over the next 3 years. Before the House vote, President Bush threatened to veto the bill if Democrats rejected his demand to raise the money from the bailout through 30-year private bonds in order to keep the costs from showing up in the federal deficit. The package is now on the Senate floor. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 4.17 points today to 2661.61. Advances led declines in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. When Alan Zweibel graduated from college, he had two choices. He could go to law school, or he could try to be a comedy writer. When no school accepted him, he started writing jokes for the comics who worked the resorts in New York's Catskill Mountains. Since then, he's won 3 Emmys. He wrote for the original cast of Saturday Night Live and co-created its Gary Shandling Show. Zweibel's latest project is The Boys, a sitcom for the Showtime cable channel. It's set in a fading New York City men's club that's struggling to keep up with the times. Most of its members are old comics and celebrities, not unlike those Zweibel first wrote jokes for or later met at New York's Friars Club.
It's the kind of place where you'd look around on any given afternoon and you'd see Mayor Abe Beam having lunch with Wilt Chamberlain, and you go, my God, what could they possibly be talking about? And it was just the juxtaposition of these varied personalities and this club that had this historic kind of air to it, beginning with Gershwin and Mayor Jimmy Walker and LaGuardia and Babe Ruth and all those people that intrigued me. So when I got the opportunity to do a show about a club like it, I did.
Now, you used to write for comics. You wrote for Borscht Belt comics, the comics who play the cats.
I started that way. I started writing for men like Morty Gunty and mm-hmm. Freddie Roman and Dick Capri and Dick Lord and Vic Arnell, and it goes on and on and on. Thousands of Bernies, thousands of Mickeys, hundreds of Lees. And ultimately, I started off writing for $7 a joke. And this was right out of college, which was 1972. And to supplement this terrific living that I was making, I was also working in a delicatessen in Queens. And you name it, I sliced it for about 3 years. And what I used to do was sell jokes to these comedians and write down jokes on paper bags and then shove them in my pocket and sell it to them.
What was the first joke that you sold?
You know something? One of the first jokes that I had ever written and no one paid me for was one of the first jokes that we did years later on Saturday Night Live. Which was about a stamp, the post office coming out with a stamp commemorating prostitution in the United States. It was an 8-cent stamp. If you want to lick it, it's a quarter. And are you allowed to say that on this radio show? We did it on Saturday night. I mean, that just goes to show you how long ago that joke was written, because I don't believe they have 8-cent stamps anymore. And it was those kinds of lines that the people I was writing for said, they're funny, but it's not for my audience. You know, these were by and large blue-haired ladies who went to resorts on the weekends and on major holidays.
So did you have to write mother-in-law jokes, honeymoon night jokes?
Oh, God, yeah. Don't touch me. I just had my hair done jokes, sending the kids to camp jokes, all the cliche kind of jokes. And it was incredibly frustrating. In its own way, it was like, well, it was great in a way. In one way, it was like writing for your father, But what was very, very interesting about it, and which was a great training ground, is what your ear got accustomed to was the way different people spoke. All right? See, what I used to do as a matter of self-discipline was I'd wake up on a Monday morning and I'd say, okay, this week we're going to talk about cars, right? So on Monday, I would write a monologue as if Woody Allen were to deliver it about buying a car. Tuesday, I would do it as if I'd write a monologue for Joan Rivers about buying a car. Wednesday, Rodney Dangerfield. Every single day, I'd take the same topic and try to put it in the mouths of other people just as a way of training myself.
Did you ever have to write jokes with Yiddish punchlines?
Oh, it's really amazing in that I used to write for a lot of the friars' roasts, where they used to roast somebody once or twice a year. And those, by and large, are stag. And what you can do is you can get laughs if you just say a couple of words and then throw in a dirty word. The shock value would get a laugh. And the same thing for a lot of these comedians. If I would just say, yesterday I bought a new chair, Rosh Hashanah, and they'd start laughing, the audience. I mean, just totally out of context. You know what I mean? If you just put in like the name of a Jewish holiday or a recipe, they would laugh.
What's an example of a way a comic really ruined one of your jokes?
Oh, that's a tough question. This isn't the perfect answer to it, but I think it sort of answers a question. Years and years later, after I had stopped writing for these stand-up comedians, I was now married. And we went up to the Concord Hotel for like a ski weekend. And we went with Al Franken, who used to be a co-writer with me on Saturday Night Live, he and his family. And we were up at the Concord and we went in to see the show. And on the bill was a man who I used to write for. And I'm sitting there and I recognized much of the material. Now, let's say this was 1986. I hadn't written for this man since 1973. Okay, so let's see, this is 13 years have gone by, and I'm recognizing the jokes as by and large the same. We went backstage afterwards to see him, or I met him in the bar afterwards, and we said hi to each other, and we got to talking, and he said, how do you like the show? And I said, terrific, really good. And he said, you see, I'm still doing your stuff. It's still holding up. I said, yeah, I'm flattered. He said, any suggestions? I said, well, one minor suggestion. You know the joke that you do about the Secretary of State? He said, yeah. I said, so I could be wrong, but as far as I'm concerned, you might get a better laugh if you took out Kissinger's name and put in George Shultz's.
And you're kidding.
No, this was 1986, and I had written in 1973 when Kissinger was, you know, and he never bothered taking out the old guy's name, and so he was doing it still in the present.
See, I find this incredibly depressing. I mean, are you depressed by that?
On one level, it's somewhat depressing. On another level, you're dealing with, in a few instances, with people who are sort of blissful and unaffected. And there's something nice about that, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not trying to wax romantic about it. But if somebody could be off by that much, do you know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to be cruel. It's like, God, my guess is that they sleep better than I do.
Did you ever go through a period of thinking, geez, I really wanted to be Lenny Bruce. How come I'm running for all these Catskill guys?
You mean back then?
Yeah.
Well, the motivation to get up and do it myself was not so much to be Lenny Bruce, because I never wanted to be a performer. I always dreamed of becoming a writer. However, what I wanted to say was certainly more than the circular driveway jokes that I was writing for these comedians. Which is why when I did my act, which was a little bit more politically bent and a little bit more, quote-unquote, current and topical at the time, I was very fortunate that one night, it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was having the hardest time. I was about 4 months into this, my stand-up career, and it was about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was having an awful hard time making 4 drunks from Wyoming laugh. This was at Catch a Rising Star. And I got off the stage sweating like a pig, and I went to the bar, and this guy approaches me, and he introduced himself. He said his name was Lorne Michaels, and this was in, I believe, April of 75. And he just looked at me and said, you know, I don't mind telling you that you're the worst comedian that I've ever seen in my life. I go, yeah, I know, I'm going to die. I have no idea what I'm going to do here. And he said, well, the material is good. Did you write it? And I said, yeah, I did. He said, well, I have this new show that's going to be starting next fall. It's going to be called Saturday Night Live, and I'm looking for writers. Would you mind showing me more of your material? And I said, you bet. So I went home, which was my parents' house on Long Island, and I stayed up for 2 days straight typing out what I thought were 1,100 of my best jokes. And I went back into the city and went to Lauren's hotel, showed him the material, and a couple of days later he gave me a job. And that was the end of my stand-up career, and it was beginning, and that was my big break. So, you know, the Lenny Bruce part, which is the answer to your question, I found that by being able to write my first job ever for a show like Saturday Night Live and be able to speak, if you will, through Chevy Chase on Weekend Update and Gilda and Belushi and Aykroyd and do the things that we did and write the things that these guys were saying and acting, I was able to express myself in a way that was probably more characteristic of how I felt humor-wise and every other way than, like I said, when I was doing the Jewish holiday jokes up in the Catskills.
My guest is comedy writer Alan Zweibel. He has 2 shows on TV now, The Boys, which is a sitcom that's on the Showtime cable network, and The Gary Shandling Show, which he co-created. He also wrote for Saturday Night Live and wrote for stand-up comics before that. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Comedy writer Ellen Zweibel is my guest. You did a lot of writing for Gilda Radner and wrote, what, Emily Latella and Roseanne Rosanna Dana?
Amongst her? Other things, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was there something about her as an actress or as a writer that worked for you as a writer?
Oh, yeah.
Were there traits in her that brought out qualities that were good in you and vice versa?
Oh, yeah. We had always kidded about it in that she was a great writer, undisciplined in that she wouldn't sit down at a typewriter and stay up all night, you know. However, whenever we would write together, it was usually by virtue of me taking a legal pad and a pen and the two of us going to a restaurant, and I would basically interview her on whatever we were going to do that week, whether it was Roseanne, Rosanna Dana, Emily Latella, any of the other things that I'd written for her. I'd say, okay, how do you feel about this? Or what would Roseanne say about that?
Mm-hmm. So you co-created the Emily Latella character with her?
That was that was based on a character that it was a nanny that was very, very important in Gilda's upbringing. A woman who's still alive, I believe she's 97 or 98 years old, her name was Dibby, and spoke like that. The character first appeared in a sketch that either Franken and Davis wrote or Rosie Schuster, and wasn't named as such. And then we started using it more and more. Then ultimately, Gilda and I hooked into it and put her in Weekend Update, and the character evolved into what it was.
Tonight's commentary is very important. Because I hear that President Ford wants to make Puerto Rico a steak. Now, why does he have to make them a steak? I didn't think those people even liked meat. Now, let me...
What's all this fuss I keep hearing about violins on television? Now, why don't parents want their children to see violins on television? I say there should be more violins on television and less game shows. It's terrible the way things... What?
Mr. Teller, that was violence on television, not violins. Violence.
Oh, well, that's different.
Yes.
Never mind.
Can you describe the creation of the Rosanna Dana character?
Well, there was once a sketch called Hire the Incompetent, that I believe Rosie Schuster wrote, where Gilda appeared with that wig. And Hire the Incompetent was interviews with three people who were clearly too incompetent to have any job anywhere. And it was successful. And months later, I was having dinner with Gilda, and I said, you know, remember that character? I said, why don't we give her a name, put her in Weekend Update, and why not give her... you know, let her be a consumer advocate, not unlike, and there was a local ABC newswoman called Roseanne Scamardella in New York at the time. I said, not unlike Roseanne Scamardella. And Gilda said, well, okay, can we call her Rosanna Dana? And I said, why? And what Gilda had done, remember that song, The Name Game, you know, Johnny,
yeah.
Bobani? Gilda started singing it, and if you sing it with the name Roseanne, somewhere in there, Rosanna Dana comes out. And I go, okay, fine, let's name her that. So every week, she would get a letter from a Richard Fader from Fort Lee, New Jersey, who's my brother-in-law. He was my best friend growing up. Then he married my sister, and it was my way of saying hi to him every week. So we made him the letter writer. And basically, we lapsed into a formula where we would take a celebrity, and we would take something topical, and we would put the two together and come up with sweat balls at the end of Dr. Joyce Brothers' nose or nasal hairs from Bo Derek or whatever we did.
So what does she do? She opens her perfect little purse and takes out a perfect little Kleenex and draws a perfect little fez and then throws a perfect little Kleenex into a perfect little Tiffany trash can. But what this cutie didn't know was when she wiped off her nose, she didn't push back in this one little perfect little nose hair. It just stuck out there, and it was long, and it was black, and it was perfect, and I thought I was gonna die. Just between you and me, Rosanna Dana, I felt like yanking down two more hairs, braiding them, and putting a bead at the end.
Roseanne.
You think you're so neat, not
Roseanne.
Just
Roseanne.
You left Saturday Night Live in 1980. Were you in the position of having to be a salesman for your own ideas after that? You know, trying to sell screenplays or TV show ideas, things like that?
Sure. Many doors opened for us in 1980 because we were coming off the show, which was very hot at the time. Although, admittedly, we were in this womb for 5 years. It was, for many of us, it was the first job we ever had in television. And you would write something on Wednesday, and it would be seen by millions of people 3 days later.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the case of Weekend Update, write it that morning or that evening and see it on television hours later. And then to start writing screenplays or pilots, which, even if they saw the light of day, wouldn't be for a year, it was like a little bit of a birth trauma.
Okay. Oh, one last thing. Any TV shows that changed your life or your fantasy life?
Those are two separate questions.
You're right.
I think that the old Dick Van Dyke show, the one where he and Mary Tyler Moore lived in New Rochelle and had a child, and he wrote for the Alan Brady show. I think I was around 14 years old when that came on the air, and it was in watching that show that I decided that that's not only what I wanted to do for a living, but also wanted to have that kind of life, have a wife and kids and live in a suburban atmosphere, and it just seemed neat. So that would probably be at the top of my list.
Do you feel like you have a Dick Van Dyke show kind of life now?
I think so. I think it's a little bit more complicated. He only had one kid, and I have three. And right now we're trying to negotiate living on two coasts, which is in and itself trying. But I think by and large that's what I always aspired to be and how to live. So I think so, yes.
Alan Zweibel, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure.
Alan Zweibel's new series, The Boys, can be seen Friday nights through the summer on the Showtime cable channel.
It's like a little poem, a classic written by my grandmother, Nana Rosanna Dan. It went like this. Listen, Roseanne, and you shall hear a little poem, my grandchild dear. I hope this don't scare you, so please don't cry, but all food you eat will make you die. If the meat is red, it'll make you fat. It's bad for your heart, and you don't want that. If the meat is white, your veins will thicken, considering the chemicals they inject in a chicken. Hot dogs, bologna, salami, forget them. No one alive knows what's in them. Since there's nuclear waste, I guess you ought to be careful you don't drink the water. Nana, I said, don't make a fuss. If food don't kill me, I'll get hit by a bus. We're all gonna die from all things or one thing. Like my daddy used to say, it's always something. But not my little Roseanne. That's the news tonight, and have a pleasant tomorrow.
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, you're following the Joseph Sosipio story.
We will. We'll be hearing from Jim Muir in Nicosia about evidently the postponement, indefinite postponement of his killing by the group which calls itself Revolutionary Justice, a group that released an announcement, first a video and then a statement today. We'll also be hearing a report from Washington by Ted Clark about what people here make of events there. And a report from Rene Montaigne on another subject about Father George Stallings, the very charismatic Catholic priest who has set up his own congregation. It's called the Imani Temple, and it draws on African as well as Catholic rites.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Ron Howard has specialized in fantasy films, Splash, Cocoon, and Willow. But while making Willow, he decided his next movie should be about something he could relate to, something from his own life. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Howard's new film, Parenthood.
Parenthood has to be a stinker, right? You've seen the cutesy ads with Steve Martin holding his children upside down and mugging. You've read the quotes about what a feel-good movie this is. And you can tell you're in for a strained bourgeois comedy about wisecracking kids and their painfully dumb dads. But this time, the marketing honchos are underselling their product. Parenthood turns out to be rich and intelligent and remarkably tough-minded. And though there are enough laughs to qualify it as a comedy, that word doesn't begin to convey the movie's seriousness of purpose, or its powerful sense of middle-class anguish. The setting is every burb USA, and director Ron Howard and his screenwriters, Lowell Gantz and Babalu Mandel, have woven their movie out of the frayed strands of the Buckman family. There's Helen, played by Diane Wiest, a divorcee whose adolescent kids have become so cool and secretive that they're downright spooky. There's Susan, played by Harley Kozak, and her husband Nathan, played by Rick Moranis. His theory of child raising involves injecting three-year-olds with heavy doses of Kafka and the higher math. And then there's Gil and Karen, played by Steve Martin and Mary Steenburgen. They're an ideal couple with a gaggle of great kids, except one of those kids likes to beat his head against solid objects, and the oldest is a sweet little guy with big enough problems to occasion a parental visit to the principal's office.
This is a public school. 38 kids to a class. We estimate that Kevin's teacher spent at least 20% of her time dealing with Kevin. It isn't fair.
It's because he was first.
Hmm?
It's because he was our first. I mean, I think we were very tense when Kevin was little. If he got a scratch, we were hysterical. But the third kid, you know, you let him juggle knives.
She smoked grass.
Gil! I never smoked when I was pregnant.
Yeah, but in college, you were like a chimney. I thought you were going to join a reggae band.
Ago.
I'm just saying there could have been some chromosome distortion. Well,
there are other threads, too. There's Martin's father, a hard drinker played by Jason Robards, and Martin's brother played by Tom Hulse, who's turned out to be a chip off the old block. He drinks like Robards and gambles like Robards, and now some mobsters want him dead. Howard sets the movie's elements in place and then watches them spin, and for the film's first two-thirds, his touch is remarkably sure. With the help of beautiful pink-tinged cinematography by Donald McAlpine, Howard carries his paradigms of parenthood as far as they can go. And if that means he gets as many winces of recognition as laughs, all the better. These are not inept moms and dads. They're conscientious and thoughtful. And yet, the destinies of children aren't susceptible to any known science, and the film often takes on a tragic cast. The actors are uniformly good, but some of them are extraordinary. Jason Robards and Mary Steenburgen, and especially Diane Wiest, haven't been this touching in years. And Steve Martin, our finest comic screen actor, outdoes himself with a performance that's surprisingly naked and poignant. Unfortunately, Ron Howard succumbs in the end to his own native sentimentality. Suddenly, during the movie's final third, insoluble problems are being merrily solved in the simplest sitcom-y ways. Words of wisdom are being dispensed by wily old grandmas. And by movie's end, everybody has gathered to hug and twinkle and smile pluckily through their tears. The last half hour is so pillowy that it almost smothers what has gone before, but it can't quite. By the time parenthood tries to paper over its doubts about the bliss of child-rearing, it's already proven itself smart enough to know better.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air is produced by Danny Miller, who also selects much of our music. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Audrey Vablitis, Thad Kirk, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Great Balls of Fire. Myra Lewis tells us about marrying rocker Jerry Lee Lewis when she was 13 and how the resulting press coverage ruined his career. Also, preserving the sounds of nearly extinct animals and disappearing jungles with bioacoustician Bernie Krause. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.